They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights.
On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew. Joining me today on the Commons, I have a friend. You know him, John Cowherd. And guess what? We're going to start off by wishing him a very happy birthday, because he has chosen to spend his birthday with us talking about HOA stuff. John, thank you so much for coming. Happy birthday, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you. I've got a daughter who is almost 2 years old, and last night as she was falling asleep, she was singing, "Happy Party to Daddy." And it was just so cute and such a perfect way to kick off my birthday, which is going to be a round number, you know, a number with a zero in it this year. I won't say which one, but you all can probably guess. So it's great to be back on the show.
Well, it's great to have you, and you you have a blog that you do with some really terrific cases and blog posts and information, and I would like you to tell us a little bit about it and give us the URL so that people can check it out. Anybody who gets my emails will have a link to it. But we have a lot of people who just listen. And so write it down. Guys, get a pen and a pencil. You want to write this down.
My blog is wordsofconveyance.com. And it's just wordsofconveyance.com, all one word. And the focus of the blog is on HOA disputes from an owner's perspective, construction defects, and really anything that touches upon or concerns real estate or construction law, with an emphasis on looking at how things kind of filter through the court system. And so there's a lot of stuff that's going on out there. I focus mainly on Virginia, but I, from time to time, I'll dip into other waters. There was a case that was recently decided by the Supreme Court of Virginia that presented a wonderful opportunity to put something up on words of conveyance, and when I shared this with Shu, she thought, you mentioned that you thought this would be a great topic for us to explore on
Absolutely.
The show. So do you want to dive into that, or do you want to?
Well, since you're the attorney, I'm going to let you go on with it. But I just want to preface this by saying that you can protect your rights. And in Virginia, the law does provide that if you have to go to court to do that, you may be able to collect your legal fees if you prevail, the winning. And, John, this has happened increasingly. I know in the Ferran case, every time they won, every time the association sued them again, they won and they asked for the they asked for their fees, and they got them. Every penny they asked for. I know in Lake Braddock we had something where the litigant also got, he was protecting his rights, and he got all of his fees, his legal fees back. So you can do it.
Right.
And this
right.
is another case.
I think focusing on the you can do it point is I think it's very important. There's a lot of articles in news sources and blogs and social media posts out there that paints a picture of HOA matters, which is very bleak. And as we know, there are a lot of problems, and those problems do need to be talked about and aired and to put out in the light of day. But there's also cases where property owners do win, and they do win big, and they do they do get justice. And I think it's important to highlight those cases, because otherwise folks might actually develop the mistaken impression that the boards and the property managers and the association's attorneys are invincible. And that's not true, as this case is a good example.
Thank you. Yeah, they're not invisible. And but I think one important point to make is that if you're going to go that route, for God's sakes, don't hire a CAI attorney, a CAI-affiliated attorney, because they do have a conflict of interest. And you need to find an attorney who understands this segment of the law. And not all attorneys do. And I think that's one of the problems that people are running into.
Right. And I think most of the larger CAI attorney law firms, just as a matter of course, don't take owner cases, and they don't return those calls, or they deal with them however, but they don't take them. I think there's some smaller solo practice attorneys who are members of CAI who might dabble in both sides of the equation. The decision to hire an attorney is a big one for anyone who does it, especially for the first time in a major case. And you really want to know who it is that you're hiring, what kind of attorney is it you're hiring. Is it a general practice attorney who kind of takes all sorts of different kinds of cases and matters that come in his door and may not have a specialized focus? Or is this someone who, their focus, their practice is only representing condo boards, or only representing big banks, or what have you? You want to know that, because when your case gets to a point where you want to trust your lawyer's judgment and his advice, you don't want to be wondering whether you picked the right person, because a lot of shrewd and aggressive attorneys out there know that one of the ways you can win is by driving a wedge between the opposing attorney and opposing client, and you just don't want to put yourself in a position where something like that might happen.
Would you recommend to the homeowner to do some homework and research to help if their attorney is not well versed in the area? I mean, I used to get calls, not so much anymore, but I used to get calls from attorneys who said, I've had these clients for years, I represent them in all sorts of other areas, they're having problems with their HOA and they want me to deal with it, and I don't want to turn them over to another attorney, but I don't know anything about this area of the law.
Well, the problem with that is I think that one of the reasons why there is this deficit of knowledge about community associations law outside of CAI is that there really isn't very many books or seminars or educational opportunities that are provided outside of CAI for the legal nuts and bolts of this kind of stuff. And if you're a general practice attorney who doesn't handle many or any of these kind of cases, you're probably not going to go and spend a whole day at a CAI convention familiarizing yourself with the inner workings of this stuff, because that's a big commitment, and it's expensive, and it takes up a Saturday out of your life. So one of the things I'm trying to do in my blog is to just put more out there and put more out there from the perspective of an owner's perspective. Keep it positive when it's appropriate to share good news. And if this allows me to get in touch with potential clients, that's great. Or if it allows me to network or provide something of value to somebody who's another attorney or a homeowner activist in another state, you know, that's great too.
So, but probably one of the best things you can do if you are a homeowner and you find yourself in the crosshairs of the association is make sure you save every single documentation, every piece of paper, every letter that you get so that you're not having to recreate things.
It's harder in this electronic age. It's actually harder to do that now than it used to be because I will get to know new clients and I find out that their text messages that they communicated with their opponent only go back for 12 months when the time when they were sold something or the deal was done was 18 months ago. So it can actually be hard to get some of this information. Sometimes people switch email servers and then the people who are doing the web hosting will write over the tapes where the emails were on. And there's all sorts of ways that electronic and paper data can be lost, especially if you're moving around because, you know, people with HOA problems tend to move eventually.
And when you
move, I don't know about you, but every time I've moved, it's like I lose some part of my knowledge base as far as my stuff is concerned. So, yes, I agree with you completely. I mean, I think that there are a number of attorneys nationwide who are focusing their practice on, or at least focusing part of their practice on representing owners and have made, who are telling folks that they're not representing boards or property managers. But not every county or city can you find somebody like that.
No,
and in such a situation, your best bet is to probably to find somebody who is a real estate trial attorney who understands how covenants work and understands how the basics of corporate law and the different how easements work and so that they're not reinventing the wheel. They're not starting from scratch and the client doesn't feel like they have to do a bunch of research on their own because it really the reason you hire an attorney is so that you don't have to go out and get your law degree from Google, as they say.
Well, that's where I got mine. No, I understand, but I mean, make sure that you keep them. You can have your covenants if you've been given the covenants and you still have them. Make sure you hand them over to the attorney. And paperwork, any letters that you get, all of that stuff. That hang on to it. I've known of homeowners who've gone into court bringing in boxes full of records, and when the attorney for the association looks at the records, they know they're screwed, and they non-suit it right there with prejudice. We're just not going to go down there because they know at that point that they are wrong, and there's no way they're going to win. Once they've noticed that the homeowner has kept every single piece of paper and has put it in a file, you have to be very, very organized and possibly a little bit nuts to do something like that, but it has helped in the past.
Right. Well, you have to do what you have to do to protect yourself.
You do. So anyway, tell us about this one case. It's good news. It's happy news for homeowners in Virginia.
Right. This is the case of Martha A. Lambert. Martha Lambert owns a condominium unit in Virginia Beach, and her association is called Sea Oats Condominium. Virginia Beach, for people who are listening from other parts of the country, is it's in Virginia. It's a beach, obviously, but it's down there near along the Atlantic coast, and it's near Norfolk, you know, where you've got the big naval base. So it's kind of a hot real estate environment. Ms. Lambert had a problem because there was this exterior door area to her unit that I assume opened out into a patio, to a balcony, or perhaps into a first floor area, maybe even onto a waterfront or something like that. I'm not, the facts aren't clear. But there was something wrong with this door. I think the door jamb didn't work properly, and something needed to be replaced to the tune of $500. So she went to her board, and she told them about it. She sent them letters. She called this and that person and didn't have any success. They were telling her that, no, this is a limited common element that is your responsibility, not our responsibility. Well, it may or may not be a limited common element, but whether it's whose responsibility it is hinges not on what somebody thinks, but what on the covenants say. And when you look at the drawings, the plats, there's an answer in those documents that tells, it's going to say whether it's the obligation of the association or the owner to make this repair, this $500 repair. So Ms. Lambert did not have success with this. Her first move was not to try to go to the courts. She tried to go to this appointed official we have in Virginia called the Office of the Community Common Interest Community Ombudsman, who has the authority to take complaints from homeowners and to consider them, to hold a hearing, and then to send them a letter saying what she could say about it. The problem with going here, as is illustrated in her case, was that the case presents two issues that have to be addressed in order for a court or some other party to make a determination. One is, how do you interpret the Declaration of Covenants? Does the if it's ambiguous or not clear, you have to make a legal judgment call. You know, how do you interpret the document? Is it whose obligation is it to repair this door jamb area? The other issue is that she was having a hard time getting documents and records from her board and was complaining to the ombudsman about the fact that they weren't providing her with copies of certain documents that she had requested pursuant to a section of the Virginia Condominium Act. Well, when she went to the ombudsman, I won't explain this in, there's three opinion letters here. You can look at them if you go onto my website. There's links to them. On the covenant interpretation issue, she told Ms. Lambert in her decision letter that she couldn't decide that point because it wasn't her, she didn't have authority to interpret covenants and to make decisions one way or another, because that's construing or interpreting a contract is that's the province of the court system, not her office. And then secondly, on the books and records, the ombudsman thought that the statute was ambiguous as to whether she was entitled to merely look at the documents or to receive copies of them. Or there was some other issue about where the ombudsman thought that there was some ambiguity in the statute. And again, she wrote to Ms. Lambert that it's a court is going to have to resolve that ambiguity, not me. I don't think that she was being difficult with her or trying to be evasive or anything like that. I think she was accurately stating her authority, which
yes.
doesn't include construing
yes.
Governing documents or statutes that people can come in and make straight-faced arguments that mean different provide different interpretations. So although she did apparently go down to Richmond at least once, possibly three times in 2013, she didn't get anything out of that whole process.
You know, John, I hear from people in Virginia all the time. I always ask them if they've been to the ombudsman. They say yes. The word that is used most often to describe her is she's useless. When I had Pietra Gianni, who's the CAI ombudsman, on, she said, if you have a homeowner who calls her up and says, I just got a proxy in the mail, what is it, and what do I do with it? She's allowed to tell them that. I said, Pierre, with all due respect, I have never had a homeowner call me and say, what do I do with a proxy? There's some serious problems, but she's not allowed. She's an attorney, but she is not allowed to address anything other than explain what a flipping proxy is and who gives a flip.
Right. Well, I don't, for whatever reason, this office is not, if you're a homeowner, I don't recommend that homeowners pursue this process of submitting a complaint to the ombudsman office, because I just think that it's likely to kind of be exhausting. It's yet another bunch of trips you have to take out of town to go and to talk to folks and to argue your case, and then at the end of it, you're probably going to get an answer like what Ms. Lambert got in 2013 in the CEO's case, which is, I'm sorry, I don't have the statutory authority to help you. Only the judiciary does. I think that's confusing to a lot of folks, because the way the ombudsman office is explained by some people as this wonderful alternative to the court system, where it's free, you don't have to hire an attorney, you don't have to pay for an arbitrator, the people with the board and with the ombudsman office, these are people who are, they're government regulators who are focused on HOA matters. So you can see how it sounds very attractive to somebody who has limited resources and has a serious problem and wants somebody to, really feels an injustice and sees, okay, well, this looks like this is the person I'm supposed to go to, but really is not what it is confusing to some people.
It's just a waste of time, John, and a waste of money, because we're paying her.
Well, I think that it, as we'll get to when we talk about when she went to court, I just think that homeowners are, with all of its challenges and weaknesses and headaches and heartaches and expenses and the consumption of time, I do think that the judiciary is head and shoulders the best place to go for a homeowner who has suffered a wrong in a specific instance. I'm not talking about wanting to go and change what the law is moving forward, but I think that there is good news with Ms. Lambert. When she went to court, she filed her case in the Virginia General District Court. General District Court is something, I think in other states it might be called District Court or might be called Small Claims Court. It is a court that has a maximum amount that you can sue for of $25,000. So you get a lot of small claims, like this $500 repair issue. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the right place to go if you have a $500 repair claim and you want to get your case resolved in perhaps 4 months as opposed to one or two years. So she filed there, and she went to trial, and she lost. The general district court judge found in favor of her association. But Ms. Lambert was not deterred. She appealed her case up to the circuit court. Because this is a small claims court where there's no court reporter and there's no juries, there's no other things that you're kind of familiar with if you watch movies about the court system. You have a right in Virginia to appeal your case to the circuit court, and it's essentially a do-over. It starts all over. The old judgment is wiped away, and the new judge doesn't even consider what the general district court judge had decided. So she went to trial in the circuit court. The association filed a demur and forced her to file briefs and try to defend the fact that her case was in court. And they filed discovery requests, which for a $500 claim is kind of, you know, to go and do document discovery in a $500 case is, I guess you can do it, but they were trying to give her a hard time. They were trying to see if they could exhaust either her or her attorney and prevail, either, you know, not because they were in the right, but because they had the resources to just...
It's a bully tactic.
Well, just to over-litigate something and to try to... act in an obstructionist manner. I'm sure that their attorney doesn't think he was being obstructionist, but we'll see how the court decided, how the Supreme Court of Virginia handled that. Well, she went to trial in the circuit court, and the judge found for her and found that she was entitled to all the $500 in repairs that she had made herself to the door because the association refused to do it. And then the issue came to attorney's fees. And she submitted an attorney's fees affidavit stating that she had incurred $8,232 in attorney's fees. And she later even asserted and submitted another affidavit for $2,650 for post-trial attorney's fees that she had incurred. And so I think for a lot of people who may be listening to the show are thinking $8,000, $10,000 for a
$500
claim. Yeah. Like, is this what's wrong about America and lawsuits in America? How can this happen? Like, someone must really be at fault here. And sometimes people have a mistaken impression that because Ms. Lambert incurred a bill of $8,000 or $10,000 attorney's fees, that was because she's litigious or aggressive or just wants to spend money in court for no reason. You know, why can't she keep the attorney's fees down to something closer to $500? Well,
it doesn't work that way.
I mean, you've got to investigate the lawsuit, review the documents, prepare the lawsuit and file it, and go to court a few times. You've got to prepare for trial. You've got to prepare witness questions. You've got to go to trial, which is a whole day. And if the attorney is charging $200, $300, $400 an hour, you can see how this can easily mushroom up to $8,000 to $10,000, especially when you've got a defendant who just their defense strategy is just to keep on, you know, writing up motions and discovery requests, putting them in an envelope and sending them out and requiring your opponent to have to respond to them in order to move on, in order to keep the case going. So Ms. Lambert was stuck in a predicament where she had a choice of either just eating the $500 charge and paying it and abandoning getting it paid by the person who was responsible for paying it under her covenants, under her contract with the board, or she could face the prospect of having to pay $8,000 or $10,000 on top of the $500,000 the $500 in order to get this resolved if the attorney's fees aren't awarded, or a third way, which is to have the attorney's fees to be, the burden to pay the attorney's fees to be shifted over to the board. And that's what this case was about on appeal. Because on the trial court level, the judge took one look at this case and said, look, I think owner's lawyer, I think you did an incredible bang-up job representing this lady. You piloted this case, and you won. There's nothing wrong with the way you handled it. You weren't. There's nothing I can complain about what you're handling. I just don't like giving her an amount of attorney's fees that's not proportional to the amount of recovery she gets, because I just don't think that's fair to a defendant who has to defend against a case like that. So he only awarded her $375, which in Virginia Beach is what senior partners charge per hour.
Yeah, I was going to say.
So in order to, for Ms. Lambert to take an award like that, and for people to use an award like that as a future benchmark, it would mean that they could only spend 1 hour of partner time on a case. And of course, that's not going to work. That's just not, yes, you could only spend 1 hour of attorney time on a case like this, but then you run the risk of missing some procedural deadline and then forfeiting your case. And it's just not something that, you know, not something that I would recommend, not an approach I would recommend taking.
And John, before we move on, is there anything in the law that would prevent, say, an association from this? It's a bully tactic because it's economic warfare, and what they're trying to do is get her to spend as much money as she possibly can so that she's left, she has to drop the case, and they win and they walk away. So I can see the judge saying, hey, wait a minute, I'm not going to give you $9,000 for a $500 case. But is there nothing to say, hey, association, you ran these fees up unfairly. Somebody's going to pay for it.
Right. And that's what the rules that are out there about the shifting of the burden to pay attorney's fees are supposed to be all about. That the Virginia Condominium Act and the Virginia Property Owners Association Act provide that in disputes over the covenants, that the prevailing party shall be awarded the reasonable attorney's fees, as you mentioned earlier in the show. The statute requires the judge to award attorney's fees.
That's in a condo, right?
Right.
But not in an HOA. You're in an HOA, you're entitled to? It's up to the judge?
Well, as we're going to get to, it ultimately is up to the judge.
Okay.
But the amount of the attorney's fees, you know, what is reasonable, that's for the judge or in some cases the jury to decide what is reasonable. But unlike some other statutes, the Condominium Act provides that if you prevail, then the court shall award the attorney's fees. So then the question becomes, well, how do you decide what is reasonable? And what this appeal was to the Supreme Court of Virginia was exploring the question of, can a judge just simply put a cap on attorney's fees and say, you've come into my court, I've awarded you $500. I'm not awarding you anything more than that in attorney's fees because that just doesn't sit right. That doesn't seem fair. Or it doesn't. There are a lot of judges out there who do feel uncomfortable about awarding $8,000 or $9,000 in attorney's fees on a $500 case because it seems like the attorney's fees has become the tail that's wagging the dog in the case.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot of people who are uncomfortable about those kinds of situations. But if something like that is happening, then it is possible for the court to take on evidence and to make a determination as to why that amount of attorney's fees has been expended. It could be that the plaintiffs are pursuing it because they're being vindictive, because they have lots of money and they just want to do everything possible to achieve a result and to get justice regardless as to what the attorney's fees are. You know, there's folks like that out there. Or it could be because one side, or it could be because the defendant is engaging in tactics designed to simply wear down their opponent and to exhaust them and to drive up their attorney's fees in the hopes that they will just throw up their hands and call it quits. And I think one of the things that this opinion stands for that was published by Justice Mims, William Mims, on April 13, 2017, is step back and to say, and it's or saying that no, the proportionality between the attorney's fees request and the amount of the judgment isn't the proper question. The proper question is, among other things, how much of her judgment how much did the plaintiff prevail on that they were asking for? If the plaintiff was asking for $100,000 and only got $10,000, then the court's saying that is something that should be taken into account in awarding attorney's fees, because if you expend attorney's fees on a case where it's determined that you only prevail by one-tenth of what you had sued them for, you've forced the defendant to defend all sorts of things that perhaps those claims should not have been brought in the way that they had been brought. So I think what this case stands for to me is that when a court looks at a request for attorney's fees, really has to look at what actually happened, how the case was litigated, what the equities are, and not simply to go with a formula that the judge feels comfortable with. And I think that this is, it should be obvious, right? But, I mean, a lot of folks, if you're a defendant and you get hit with a $500 judgment and an $8,000 attorney's fees award, you're probably going to be thinking about appealing it, right? Because it seems like you've been spanked, you've been hammered, you've been punished for going to court when you had no choice but to go to court because you were sued. But as we know from this case, that the HOA wasn't forced to go to court. They could have spent the $500 and simply solve the problem, and no one would ever have spent a dollar on attorneys.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what one thing that's important about this case is that I think that boards are, when they are properly counseled by their attorneys, are going to be much less likely to adopt these kinds of strategies because they may not get away with it. And that hopefully the trickle-down effect of this Lambert versus Sea Oaks condominium case will be that more boards will simply agree to do what the governing documents obligate them to do, and not to pursue these kinds of litigation defense strategies that make for interesting reading, but you know, that's not what people sign up for when they purchase condominiums. You purchase a condominium to have a home or an investment, not to have a potential day in court.
You know, it's interesting with this case because and I don't know if the same is true here in Virginia or in other states, but in Florida, there's an attorney, Barry Silver, who's taken on so many cases pro se for the homeowner. And has won the cases, and when he's won the cases, he has asked the association to pay his fees. And the judge, in his case, there were a number of cases where there was a multiplier, because the case was so, you know, the judge asked him, do you think, you know, what were the chances of you winning this case? And depending on what the odds were, they have given him 1.5 to 2.5 times his normal fee.
Right, right.
And I think that's only because it was because he'd taken it on pro se. I don't know if there's a multiplier here. You're saying, oh, wait a minute, you know, we can't do this because you only went to court over $500 and you're now asking for $9,000 in attorney fees, so we're having a hard time doing that. But the fact is that you've had to spend a lot of time hire an attorney. Your attorney has had to spend a lot of time going after and just protecting your right.
Right, but now in the wake of this opinion, trial judges aren't allowed to do that anymore. They're no longer permitted to do this, you know, I gave you got $500 in judgment, I'm not going to give you your full attorney's fees.
They're going to have to give them the full attorney fees?
Well, they have to go through all the factors of in determining whether the attorney's fees request is reasonable. They can't, what the court is saying here is not that they have to give them all of them, but that they can't, the trial judge cannot short circuit the analysis by just applying a percentage and then moving on to the next case. You know, there's, in these kind of cases, there are a number of factors that trial judges are required to consider, including the time and effort expended by the attorney. You know, that's, you know, the number of hours being spent, the nature of the services rendered, the complexity of the services, the value of the services to the client, the results obtained, whether the fees incurred were consistent with those generally charged for similar services, and whether the services were necessary and appropriate. So one of the things that this case opinion is saying is that the trial judge has to consider those factors and can't just apply a percentage as a kind of easy way of avoid considering all those factors, because this percentage approach doesn't necessarily, it might do justice in some cases, but it has the potential to just add insult to injury. If the contract, by which I mean the Declaration of Covenants, requires the board to pay a $500 repair, but you have to spend $8,000 to $10,000 in attorney's fees to get to the point where they pay that $500 for that repair, then it's most people will simply just not, they'll pay the thing themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's cheaper to pay $500 than it is to go and incur $10,000 in debt. And you never know if you're going to win in court or not. It's a gamble.
Right, right. And most people will just pay the $500. But for a lot of folks, there may not be an option to just simply pay the $500 yourself. What if the problem that you're encountering is with a common area? What if it's with a common area that you don't have the authority to go in and to do work on that common area? What if the common area is flooding your property? What if there is some structural problem with the building or with something where if the board doesn't make the repairs to a common area that they own and that they control, then you can't sell your unit. In those cases, I mean, your choice might be to you know, either completely lose your investment to kind of live in this property you can't sell for the rest for a long time, or to rent it out, or to sell it at a loss, or you know, those aren't real options. You know, those aren't losing the value of your investment is not something that it's just not acceptable. And those are the kinds of, I mean, yes, this is a case about a $500 door jam, but this opinion and what this represents is going to be useful and valuable for homeowners who are facing situations where if the board doesn't do what they're obligated to do, they may not be able to sell their property because the problem may render it unmarketable.
What about risks that you take when you do something like that? It's common. It's part of the association's responsibility. The condo is responsible for that. You fix it because they refuse to fix it. Down the road, something happens. And they'll come back and say, John, you messed this up and your repairs have caused additional damages
right.
to other units, or you created a leak, or
right,
you know,
right.
you did something that has created more damage. So you're then on the hook, potentially, for having caused damage to a much greater area.
Right, right. And then in a $500 door jam case, the problem you've articulated is less obvious, but there are lots of disputes where you have exactly what you're talking about. You know, you by taking matters in their own hands, an owner may making things easier for themselves in the short run, but what if the board thinks that the change, just the simple act of doing it, violated the covenants because they're not allowed to work on the common
yeah.
area, or that they think that the change violated the architectural guidelines. It would be, they're tough, especially for the property owners who are living in these properties. And in many of these situations, you've got the property owner owns and lives their unit, their townhouse, their condo unit, their single family home. And everybody else they're dealing with has no skin in the game. The board members are probably not going to be punished if they make a mistake or do something bad. The property manager gets paid, you know, if the case goes well or if the case goes poorly. The association lawyer maybe is being paid either out of assessments or by the insurance company. The owner is gambling with house money in the way they try to resolve these disputes, whereas everybody else is protected, or they're, you know, they've got one of these cases with this homeowner, and they might have a bunch of other disputes boiling up elsewhere, and this is just one thing that they have to deal with, and it's not, for them, this is not their home and their number one investment. This is just something that has to be worked through and will be decided one way or the other.
Sometimes you hear from people who are just so totally frustrated. They live in a condo. The condo is supposed to repair things. Sometimes there's a problem with the roof and the roof leaks in, or there's a problem with a leaky pipe in the walls and it affects their units. And so they go to the board and they say, look, we have this problem. And the condo board just pretty much ignores it. And they won't fix it. They don't like you. They don't want to spend money on that building. They would rather put the money in a different building. You know, whatever the things come up. Is it fair? I mean, there was a case in Chicago in Spanish court, too, where the homeowner had a similar problem. I mean, she kept going to the board and saying, hey, there's a problem with my condo, and the condo refused to do anything about it. She stopped paying her assessments. And she went in court, and the court said that it's a contract.
Right.
It's a two-way contract. I agree to buy this and pay you X number of dollars, but you are responsible for making the repairs. And if you don't do that, then why should you continuously have to pay? Well, of course, it went to the appeals court, and the appellate level overturned it because CAI just went into, oh, my God, you know. Nobody ever thinks of the homeowner. It may just be one who's having problems in his or her unit, and the condo board shrugs the shoulder, and they say, oh, well, you know, you can't punish the board because you're going to be punishing all the other homeowners. Should there be a law that says if the condo does not stand or breaches their duties and responsibilities, that you shouldn't have to pay for them?
Well, there's it's interesting that you mentioned that. In the Virginia Residential Landlord-Tenant Act, there is a statute that says that if the owner of an apartment of a rental unit fails to perform some basic services, like keep the place from rain from getting in, or an infestation of pests, or any of these. No, we're not talking about my roommate ate my yogurt. We're talking about some major stuff is wrong, such that the person is either has to leave the apartment or is forced to live in kind of third world conditions. Then there's a procedure where the tenant can go and escrow their rent with the court until the case goes to trial, at which the judge would have the authority to award the rent to the landlord, to give it back to the tenant, to split it up, to order the landlord to fix the problem, to terminate the lease, to let the tenant out. There's all sorts of remedies he can decide once that rent escrow case goes to trial. This is law in the books in Virginia that is used from time to time in big apartment complex cases. Sometimes you'll find, I've actually did one of those last year. There's no comparable provisions in the Condominium Act.
So yeah, and so for
at least in Virginia.
For a tenant, well, I don't know of it anywhere else. I think it had been proposed as legislation in Illinois, and it didn't pass. Of course, you know, CAI didn't want that going through. Oh, we can't have that. Oh, my God, then all these people. That's okay. We're just going to protect bad board members and incompetence, and, you know, but we can't.
I mean, I don't know why they didn't want it. I mean, it would have been, you know, it's more cases to litigate, and there are a lot of procedural, there are a lot of little procedural rules with those rent escrow cases where a tenant, especially one who isn't represented by counsel, can kind of lose their case by forfeit. So I'm surprised that there isn't some legislation out there that would create this long and winding path where some assessments escrow case could be brought under a very limited set of circumstances, but there isn't. I mean, I think that I would strongly support legislation like that. I'm sure that it would be strongly opposed by some folks that we know, but
wonder why.
But it kind of shows that in many ways tenants have more rights in buildings than condo owners.
They do.
And that's just the reality of it. And no one ever explains to property owners when they purchase condos or houses in HOAs that your only real remedy to get what you are entitled to under these governing documents, if the board doesn't agree, is to bring a lawsuit. You don't have, there's no escrow, you don't get to file a lien, you don't get to foreclose, you don't get to fine, you don't get to withhold your assessments. You've got and you don't really have a appointed regulatory official who is a kind of a pro bono lawyer / pro bono prosecutor / pro bono judge who's going to solve all your problems. So I think that the answers for owners are one, reforming the laws, and two, making it easier to bring these cases and succeed on them in court. And I think that this Martha Lambert versus Ciotz case, while it doesn't solve all homeowners' problems, it's a strong step in the right direction.
John, happy birthday again, and thank you so much for joining us. We are out of time. Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.